I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Heather Breaux, here we are. You came down from Oakland, California, to spend time on the Central Coast.
Absolutely.
What brought you here?
I have a couple of reasons to come to SLO. My brother lives here, and also one of my closest sailing friends, actually, is here at Cal Poly.
So you're a journalist, right?
I am a journalist.
Yeah. You write for a sailing yachting magazine, Latitude.
Yeah, I've been writing for Latitude for 4 years now. I've written a couple other publications, too, Berkeley Side and some Straight News. But I really enjoy profile features and
people's
stories.
So you've had quite a fascinating journey, your life journey.
You flatter me.
Well, you're only, what, 30?
Yeah, in 3 months.
Yeah, coming on 30. And yet you lived in Paris, lived in France. How did that happen?
Long and the short of it is that ever since I can remember, I wanted to live in France. I went to the library and I read all of the Jane Austen, Elizabeth Gaskell, Charles Dickens, and I was so immersed in that world. And then I saw on the shelf next to it, there was one translation of Les Miserables by Victor Hugo, and I read it, and I was hooked. There was such a difference, and I wanted to go live there in the city.
And you did.
And I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did you survive when you were there?
I was a student, and so when I first moved to France, I moved to Bordeaux, which reminded me a lot of home. It's the wine country in France.
Similar latitude to here.
Similar latitude. Yeah. It's a similar distance from the coast. There are a lot of similarities. I think it's best enjoyed out of school with a proper job and income. Absolutely loved being accessible to the southwestern part of France and Spain, North Africa. It was amazing.
What was your major?
I came into Berkeley as a French literature major, and then I couldn't let my love of British literature go, and I convinced them to let me do a third year and finish a double major at Cal. And I was thinking the whole time, this is my last chance. I've got to make the most of this third year, because I was a transfer student. And I thought, this is my shot to go to France. I could take my scholarship money and continue my studies in this country that's fascinated me for so long. And so that's what I did.
Did you live on campus in a dorm or in the town?
In Bordeaux, I lived with two homestays, which has both advantages and disadvantages. And actually, I did meet some of my closest friends from Bordeaux. They were host families. It was a little harder to access the social life in Bordeaux immediately, but I lived in two different suburbs of Bordeaux, and you get a flavor of the real life, the real Bordelais rhythms and things.
And in what most marked ways did the culture and the people differ from, like, the west coast of California to Bordeaux, for example?
Oh, wow. Where to begin? I think in the end, we're the same. There's not, you know, terrible differences to reckon with, but one that I noticed seems to be an interesting thing to discuss with expats too in the Bay is how you make friends and what the timeline is on being close or feeling like you've reached a real closeness with a friend. In France, it takes a lot longer, but once you are friends, you're probably friends for life. In California, I think especially coastal California, I feel like you're everyone's friend. It doesn't matter how long you've known each other. You might go on a road trip after 5 minutes of meeting, or you may never see them again. It depends.
My time in Germany, one of the disconnects, first morning in Frankfurt, coming down the elevator, and all these German business people, and I basically go, howdy, guys. And they're going, you are not German.
Why are you smiling at me?
Exactly. Yeah, why are you looking me in the eye? And it was literally, to be appropriate, you go, Morgan. And not look them
in
the
eye. So those rumors are true.
I know.
That's funny.
So that's one of the huge disconnects being an American in Paris or wherever.
I can confirm. I think in Paris, though it's a much larger city and it's so much more transitory, there's people from all walks of life coming and going and lots of career paths and interests there. I think that smiley California bubbly personality doesn't necessarily translate very easily in the Parisian social scene. I think you have to navigate with hair. It's a bit of a dance, which I had a leg up on since I had spent almost 6 or 7 months in France before I moved to Paris, which was a great way to make the transition to living in that city. Mm-hmm. I had the language and some of the cultural norms.
My French is abysmal. It's just, no. You know, really minimal.
Did you have 2 years in high school?
No.
Everyone says that.
Yeah. But I was warned before, especially going to Paris, of how rude the French are to Americans, you know, that don't speak the language. And I found the opposite. You know, I came up to a gendarme and I needed directions to get to the metro. And he knew. I mean, it was obvious. I had like 7 words lexicon.
Just enough to get in trouble.
But he went out of his way, you know, was so kind and welcoming, knowing that I had miserable French. I was touching, you know, and that was my typical experience.
Well, I think that is typical. If you are showing an effort and intention and some level of care, I think this really goes a long way, as it would with anyone, right? If you get to take the time to understand someone's culture and their language and their history, of course you respect that effort and you do your best to help.
Talk to us about epiphanous moments, kind of game changers in your life because of going away from America and immersing in France. Oh, I know it's
that's a big
one.
Question.
cast the net widely.
I think a couple of things come to mind. So first of all, when I moved to France, it was my third time traveling to Europe. And of course, my first love had been British literature, and so my first travels were to London. And I remember doing a walking tour with my class, and I just had this moment where I thought, oh my gosh, the first London metro tube station was built in, you know, the time of Charles Dickens and these greats walking the streets of London. It was odd to realize they were writing these stories about Victorian times. So I think realizing that those authors I loved so much, the greats that we think of, that we have in our standard literature education in the U.S., these people saw these cities unfolding and the technology changing and just realizing there's a context for these, for Oliver Twist, there's a context that you can still find hints of in these ancient cities today.
And you can literally go to the same neighborhood.
You can, and you can find the landmarks that you read about in the books. And I found Lloyd's Bank. It's a tiny little building. It looks like it's from the 1700s, and it has a tiny little gold beehive on top of the door lintel. And you wouldn't know that it's this World Bank, but it used to be a market, and the market grew with colonialization and the global trade emerging into something quite significant. And this was along Charles Dickens' daily walk to the court and his other various pursuits. So that was one of those epiphanies where I realized this is why I'm studying literature. It's still here. Fairly exciting.
That's so cool. Another component of France and French people is the multicultural dimension, because of the hundreds of years of French colonialism that many of the, you know, Algerians or Moroccans or whatever have immigrated to France.
Yes.
Talk to us about that multicultural dimension of Paris today and France.
Something that feels close to my passion there on why I chose to learn French, because I realized I was sort of handicapped as a student of books. I couldn't read Victor Hugo in the French. And I really wanted to, and I couldn't read the poets in French. And I was thinking, that doesn't exist. I have to read translations. And then I learned you can actually study French at Berkeley. It's really cool. And so I realized that when you learn a language, it's a doorway that opens up so many other countries. And you get to meet people, you read their literature, you understand what they're saying to you on the street, you interact with the place in a much more intimate fashion. It's not just pragmatism. I think it's language and culture are so linked. So to imagine the centuries of influence back and forth between Francophone people in different countries is really something quite interesting. There's always fascination.
So reading literature in the primary language is different.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, wow. I would say how you phrase an idea is different. It's not a linear translation. I mean, mm-hmm. this is, of course, it's obvious, but it sounds correct because French poetry has rules and traditions going back to the beginning of poetry that you cannot necessarily approximate in English. There's rhyming schemes and there's emphasis and there's patterns and rules on how you string consonants and vowels together that once you really get into the weeds of poems, they mm-hmm. start to sound, they hit your ears differently than it's the same beautiful sentiment would in an English translation.
Interesting. Jumping forward, you're back in America in mm-hmm. Oakland now, and you're a writer.
I am a writer.
Yeah, so have you noticed, observing yourself, that you've shifted your voice in how you phrase sentences and paragraphs and stories?
Yeah, I think inadvertently, anytime you really try to immerse yourself in another language, it's going to happen. It's probably best seen in maybe a slight degradation of my English, if I'm honest. If you're not focusing on growing your primary language and you're focusing so hard on learning everything you can about another language or pronunciations and the complexities, it's like any other muscle. It sort of grows weaker with mm-hmm. inattention. So that's one for sure. I need to actually be strategic and continue mm-hmm. to have this academic, you know, Berkeley vocabulary that
has your voice shifted to more poetic or more linear?
Well, at the risk of sounding really pretentious, I have to think it has to have shifted towards something more poetic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the beauty of reading French books. They're just inherently so beautiful. The abstract pulled out of everyday quotidian happenings is a remarkable trait of French literature, and that's something that's really fun to explore.
Interesting.
What you start to notice about Paris when you're there, especially with how you see Paris through the lens of fiction or writing that was activism fictionalized, is how much the city's evolved and changed. And it's really impressive when you go to the heart and center, you're on the Seine River looking at this waterway that's been there since it drew the city to life. Essentially, and all you can see around you is cobblestones and Haussmann buildings, and it's it's like a gorgeous romantic city, but you're thinking, you know, what did it look like in the revolution? Was it like the movie? Was it like barricade? You know, what did it look like? And I think that's something, it comes to life when you travel, is you start to see the cities with an imaginative eye, imagining what the history would have looked like and how the city's changed. And so while I'm not an expert in the Revolutionary War times, you know, there's castles that are being restored in the countryside that I've been following on Instagram, and those people broke a wax seal that had been stamped at the end of the revolution and hadn't been unsealed for hundreds of years, and it's inspiring to be surrounded.
Yeah. In Bordeaux, you were talking about that and how much you liked Bordeaux. And part of that was that comfort, that feeling of familiarity of environment.
Yeah, yeah. Bordeaux is of course, every region in France is something unique for food and wine. They have an incredible relationship to land. And Bordeaux is no different. There's left and right bank Bordeaux wines to explore and taste to cultivate. And there's, of course, cheese and much good food. And the countryside's beautiful because it's agricultural and there's still a connection. And when you look at the riverfront now, it's gorgeous. It's modern. It's like a shopping center. There's so much to do, these bars, but you get into the old town and you're suddenly lost in these winding cobblestone streets that make you feel like you're back in the Middle Ages. And then you pop out on the riverfront and it's like a lovely promenade. And just thinking how different Bordeaux looks as it used to, you can go to a museum there and see paintings where there's big trade ships coming down the river and it's just covered in sails and masts. It's not like that today. But
were you able to get over to Normandy?
I did visit Normandy. I took a road trip up to see Verdun. I didn't really get to see much of, like, the cute thatched roofs and the legends. That Normandy and Aix-en-Provence are two places that are still on my list to go to.
Oh, cool. So something happened and you came back across the pond.
Just a little something.
What brought you back?
I was obliged. COVID happened. I had bought a one-way ticket, I thought. I didn't think I was ready to make something of myself there and have a new life. I was really thinking. I had this internship in Paris. I was working at a little tiny publishing house, and I was living my dream. I loved this city, and I had prepared so long and hard to get there, and the language component was finally kicking in, and I had made some really lovely friends through a swing dancing community that I discovered, and I didn't want to leave.
So that being said, you had to come back.
I had to. I think that, of course, no one is ever forced to do anything in their life, right, but I felt like I had to choose to come back.
Yeah.
It was a lot of uncertainty.
Well, now we're post-COVID, hopefully, forever. Any thoughts about going back? Or are you kind of settled in Oakland, Berkeley now?
I would love to go back one day. I try to go back as much as possible, and I've been so lucky, I think, with my lifestyle. That's one of the silver linings of what I fell into after college. I had the latitude to go and travel quite a bit. So I spent 4 weeks there last summer, and before that I had spent almost a month in the winter time. And it's a place that will probably forever feel homey, even if I don't have that same drive to make it my own again. I feel so fortunate that I was able to go. And that I had the fall semester before the pandemic, because I had so many friends in this exchange for the spring who had arrived in January. And then in March, they were on a plane home. And
wow.
I've traveled quite a bit, and I think that there's so much more of the world to explore. I don't necessarily feel, as you said, there's other Francophone countries too.
Mm-hmm,
and those are on my list.
Well, you always do French Tahiti.
Oh, I'd love to sail there.
So here you are, and another layer of your onion of heather is you're a skipper of sailing vessels.
Almost a skipper.
On what type of vessels?
Mostly chartered sailboats.
Like
so a few
40, 50, 60 footers?
Yeah, the two that I work most on are 50 feet.
And
they're blue water racing boats, so they travel well, but they're also spacious and comfortable.
Nice. Yeah. They're based in Berkeley Marina?
Yeah, this company I work for four or five companies and probably more than that of different captains doing different work. But mostly I sail from Oakland, like the Jack London scene, Alameda, Sausalito, and Berkeley too, yeah.
And a dynamic that a lot of people don't realize, San Francisco Bay looks very Pacific, very peaceful at first glance, but it's a brutal place to sail a vessel, especially out towards the Golden Gate.
This is very insightful, and it's something that, unless you're in a wind sport, you might not know that San Francisco is known the world over as being the best place to sail.
Or the most brutal.
Depending on what boat you're on, And I was sailing dinghies at Community Sailing Club in Berkeley through my time at Berkeley at Cal. And so when I started chartering, I had gone from 15-foot dinghies where you're in a wetsuit and you capsize and you're in the water. It's very athletic. You have deadlift your body weight plus soaking wet wetsuit and foul weather gear. And, it's quite a physical endeavor, one of the most empowering things you could do. But you're there in Berkeley with the full force of the wind coming at you from under the Golden Gate. So if you can sail there, you can sail anywhere.
So you're in the process right now of qualifying for your United States Coast Guard's skipper's license, right?
Remarkably, I mean, sometimes life throws an accidental jibe at you in the sailing parlance. But I didn't expect to be a sailor. I didn't train to be. I just loved it so much, and it ended up really changing my life. And so then chartering is on a bad day, I say it's kind of like being a glorified waitress. You're really just shuffling sandwiches around and kind of tugging at the lines to make sure the boats balance. But on a good day, you're learning so many skills and how to handle sailboats in an environment that's often quite unforgiving. So you know.
And you've been outside the Golden Gate. You've gone down to the Channel Islands. And
yeah, I sailed a little bit out of Long Beach and Ventura.
Wow.
Santa Barbara.
So in your sleep, you're writing stories for magazines.
Yeah, I'm always thinking about something. There's always, and I think sailing is a lovely niche, since what I've written about most recently is how sailors actually have a lot of influence over the Western culture that we know today. Mm-hmm. And when you just dig a little deeper, any one small thing on a boat can turn into a whole feature length story.
Wow.
With interesting characters and drama and, you know, tech innovations. So,
well, we're going to have to do a part two, Heather.
Yes.
Bro. But before we go, let's talk about digging deep into your past. You're Acadian, right?
Yeah. Yep. I am a bro.
Talk to us about that.
I think this is maybe something many of us can relate to, is having kind of grown up without a clear sense of your cultural heritage. And it's something I've tried to explore on my own as I've grown older. My grandfather, his first language was Cajun French. And so I think that was also a big influence in my curiosity, was understanding the history.
Let me interject for a moment, because I've been in the Deep South, and people talk about Cajun this and Cajun that, and they don't even know where that word came from, its derivation.
It's an interesting study, too, because there's politics involved and some really complicated feelings about, you know, how you choose what your own identity is.
Because you guys were deported by the British out of French Canada.
Yes, and so the bros, there are many bros now in Louisiana, and they come from French immigrants. B-R-E-A-U-X. And if you're in Louisiana and you order Tony Shashir's gumbo mix on the phone, it's nice. They say, is that with an X or without? Normal. It's so normal. But here in California, it's a little more unusual to find bros, though we are there. And the Cajun culture is alive and well. There's Zydeco dancing in Berkeley. So that's something that is a forever curiosity, is to understand how my family came to Louisiana, what happened to them in the state over the hundreds of years, and, you know, how we ended up in California. And it's a tale of great personal reinvention, relentless, tireless, innovative personal reinvention.
Yeah. Have you traced your roots and gone to New Brunswick and gone to Acadia?
I visited a town in France where some of the ancestors came from. Mm-hmm. And really, there's two cities, and I think one city is in Brittany and another is in the east of France.
So that's got to be on your hit list.
Oh, yeah. Well, my list is so long at this point, it's hard to know where to start.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandfather did do a lot of research before he passed and made some interesting discoveries. I mean, the tale is never crystal clear, and I think there's so much more to discover.
That's so cool. Literally, let's regroup for part two of Heather Bro's journey. I love it.
Thank you.
Yeah. But next time I see you, you'll probably be a certified Coast Guard skipper.
It's a little longer of a process than that. Fingers crossed, that would be amazing.
Yeah. To learn more about your world, I know you've got to have a website and LinkedIn profile. How would somebody find out more about Heather Bro?
You can definitely check out my portfolio website, and that's hmbro.com. I've got all my stories up there. Of course, Instagram. And LinkedIn, if you're curious about the educational sort of more career pathway in the Bay.
Heather Bro, thanks again.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
You've You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
World Bicycle Relief partners with communities to deliver specially designed, locally assembled, rugged bicycles for people in need. Nearly 1 billion people in rural regions of the world live in communities far from the nearest paved road, walking miles every day just to survive. Distance is a barrier to attending school, receiving health care, delivering goods to market, and other critical services needed to thrive. Find out how you can help deliver rugged, dependable, life-changing bicycles to deserving communities. Log on to worldbicyclerelief.org to learn more.
I wasn't small, and I lost my heart under bad red skies. Don't ever be a heartbroken stranger like me. Ever be a heartbroken stranger like me.